Welcome to Free Thoughts from Libertarianism.org and the Cato Institute. I'm Trevor Burrus, a research fellow at the Cato Institute Center for Constitutional Studies.
I'm Aaron Ross Powell, editor of Libertarianism.org and a research fellow here at the Cato Institute.
Our guest today is Scott Bullock, senior attorney at the Institute for Justice. Approximately 10 years ago, I think in February 22nd, I think, is if I remember correctly.
I think that might be right.
You argued – I did look it up, so it wasn't just stuck in my mind. But, you argued a case in front of the Supreme Court called Kelo versus City of New London, which has become kind of famous. As Supreme Court cases go, it's become relatively famous. Can you tell us what that case was about?
Well, the Kelo case was about an attempt by a group of neighbors in the Fort Trumbull neighborhood of New London, Connecticut to try to save their homes. Their homes were sought by the City of New London and a private development corporation that wanted to take them, bulldoze them, and turn the their former neighborhood into a high-end mixed-use development where there was going to be a five-star hotel, luxury condominiums, office space, originally a health club, and other private development projects. When a group of seven of the property owners who owned 15 parcels of property refused to sell to the city invoked its eminent domain power to take those properties to hand over to a private developer in the name of economic development.
And eminent domain is for our listeners not familiar with that.
Sure. Eminent domain is a longstanding power of the government. It has been called from the earliest days of America the despotic power of government because it is one of the most serious and threatening things a government can do to its citizens, short of taking your life or maybe throwing you in jail. To take away your home, your business, your land is about as potentially draconian as it gets. So in the U.S. Constitution and virtually every other state constitution, the framers were so concerned about abuse of that power that they put important limitations on it. And that's in the Fifth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution that says, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation, placing two important limits on the eminent domain power. If the government takes your property, they have to pay you for it. I mean, there's a whole dispute about what constitutes just compensation. But the more fundamental limitation is that the government can take your property, can only take your property if it is for a public use. And most people know what that is. That's a road, a bridge, a public building, sometimes public utilities, something that either the public owns or that everybody has a right to use. Members of the public have a right to use. But over the past 50 or 60 years at the Supreme Court and in many states, that clause, that public use requirement has been watered down and it led to the Kelo case where public use was transformed in the Berman case in the 1950s and in the 1980s into public purpose. And then eventually in the Kelo decision from 2005, the Supreme Court said, well, let's read that to mean public benefit. And what are the public benefits? Well, it was supposedly going to be more tax revenue and more jobs created by the new development project in New London.
I guess what's wrong with that? In the sense that, I mean, the broadly speaking, taking some property from some people in order to benefit other people is
– or people in general.
Is what – I mean is like more or less everything that our government does, right? I mean that's healthcare subsidies are taking some money from some people to give it to others. We do it all the time. So what's – what's wrong with taking someone's house to turn into tax dollars?
Right. Well, the most important thing – I mean all those you could question as well and that might even be a broader discussion as to what constitutional limits there are on federal and state governments beyond the public use provision. But this is an absolutely an essential part of the Constitution. It's in the text of the Constitution that says that property can only be taken for public use, which almost by its very definition disqualifies what was really going on here, which was private use. That is what happened in the Kelo cases, that they were taking land from one private owner and turning it over to another private owner in the hope that that new private owner would produce more tax revenue. And that's just textually contrary to the Constitution. And it is something, too, that it's a view of eminent domain without really any sort of limitation whatsoever. And that was the real problem with the Kelo decision. Is any piece of property would produce more tax revenue and more jobs if it were a business. Because all the government has to do, as we can talk about what happened in the aftermath of the Kelo case, is project that this new project will create X number of jobs and X number of tax X amount of tax revenue, and somebody could always come up with a higher and better use of your property than you were making it. And that was the real danger in the Kelo is still the real danger in the Kelo decision, and that's what we were asking the Supreme Court to do, was to at least place some outer limits on the eminent domain power.
That seems particularly dangerous for poor people.
Well, that's the one of the big problems with eminent domain. I mean, there are so many, but one of the big ones is that this unquestionably falls hardest on the poor and minority groups as well. That's been historically true, and it's true up to this day as well. Eminent domain is typically targeted at neighborhoods that are longstanding neighborhoods. There might be a lot of elderly folks there, poor individuals, and cities want to do it because they have the lure of more tax dollars. Developers love it because they don't have to sit down and negotiate one-on-one with property owners the way, thankfully, most land deals are done in this country. So it really turned into this unholy alliance between big developers, big businesses like big box retail stores, and local governments desperate for tax revenue, and it falls hardest to this day on those on the poorest individuals in society.
When we hear about these kinds of just on their face absurd actions by government, like we're going to steal someone's house and give it to this rich guy, I'm always curious about the motivations or the thinking of the public officials involved. I mean, were they – it's easy to picture them as like, you know, sitting in a dark smoke-filled room with, you know, these
That's
business leaders
and, them, yeah.
and like saying, yes, this is vile, but we're going to do it because we want to scratch your back and then you'll give me money or a job when I get out of office. But is that really how it looks, or do they think that they're actually doing something in the public good?
It's a great question, and one of the problems with having this in court and allowing these types of takings to take place is that it's very difficult to get into the minds of the folks that are making these decisions. Typically in court, you don't have the smoking gun moment, the Jack Nicholson versus Tom Cruise moment in the courtroom where you have a breakdown and you get a city official to say, you're right, I did it all for Pfizer, I did it all for Costco. That typically doesn't happen.
That's what you dream about at night.
Exactly. Yes. You could dream about it, but usually it doesn't happen that way. And so what you're left with is kind of scant evidence about what they're doing. Oftentimes you have city officials that, like what happened in New London, molding their development plans exactly to what a private company wanted. But I think for most city officials, there's mixed motivations as the way a lot of people behave, that they doing the bidding of a certain company, but they ultimately think, well, yes, it's going to be good for them, but it will also be good for our city. And that was the approach, I think, in New London. They thought what is good for Pfizer is good for New London. So you had a lot of mixed motivations trying to separate that out is very difficult to do. But I'll make one other point about this though too, is that what I think was one of the real problems and frankly tragedies in the majority's opinion is they had a very pristine view of how municipal decision making is done, where they think that, well, and Justice Stevens in his majority opinion talked a lot about the planning process that the city went through, and they had studies and they listened to everybody and they got approvals from various agencies step by step, and he thought, well, this is really impressive. And then you had somebody like Justice O'Connor who wrote the dissenting opinion, a very passionate opinion, and what I would call a very real-world opinion as well.
And she had been an elected official.
Exactly right, Trevor, because that's something where you debate is good to have political officials or elected officials on the Supreme Court. I think in something like this, it was a real benefit certainly to her opinion. Being a state official, She knows how these deals go down. Usually they're decided before the public hearings, and most of the kind of approvals that they go through are dog and pony shows because all the very important people got together in town and wired it from the get-go. And I think she saw that in a way that many members of the Supreme Court, who I don't even know when the last time they ever attended a city council meeting, did not really understand.
So going back, as you kind of mentioned the story a little bit, but the interesting thing on these cases, especially from you as a litigator side and also what the Institute for Justice does generally, is how did you find Suzette Kelo? What happened in the beginning when you first got your hands dirty? When did you – how did you bring it up through the case? I mean the whole – how did you bring it up through the courts? When did you start thinking maybe we could bring the Supreme Court? Did that ever hit you or was it just always a surprise kind of?
Well, absolutely. I mean from the very beginning of our cases, we designed them to try to maximize the ability for us and for the clients to win the case, but then also to set a long-term precedent that will benefit other property owners, other Americans that find themselves in similar situations. So we're always looking for those cases that present those opportunities for a cutting-edge legal issue, sympathetic clients, outrageous facts, and quite frankly, evil villains then as well. And there was no shortage of those in the New London case or in any eminent domain case that we've ever been involved in.
So, now, were you guys keeping an eye out too on the public use part of the Fifth Amendment?
Absolutely. I mean that was – we got involved in this in the mid-90s and our goal as a public interest organization was try to change the law in this area. We thought it was an essential part of the Constitution. It was something that was clearly being ignored and courts for a long time were just rubber stamping whatever governments wanted to do in this area. And so we set out with a long-term mission of fundamentally changing the law and changing the climate of public opinion to make these sorts of takings unacceptable. So we were looking for cases that would further that agenda and also challenging the outer limits of eminent domain. We also – one of the areas that we were looking at is so-called blight cases and that stems from a lot of the cases in the 1950s where governments declared certain areas blighted and used that as an excuse for taking property and we wanted to challenge that. But then governments were also just taking land because they said – like in New London, we need more tax revenue, more jobs, more economic growth. That's a good enough justification. That's what they were doing in New London and that's one of the reasons why we picked it. It came to our attention by one of the local activists in the area writing me a letter and I read it and said, this sounds outrageous and I called him up, gathered more information and then I traveled up to New London and met the folks there and brought in other colleagues at the Institute for Justice, in particular Dana Berliner, who was a co-counsel with me on this case. And that we decided that this would make a fantastic vehicle for both challenging the use of eminent domain for economic development purposes and also trying to save these people's homes.
And there's even more to Suzette Kelo's story about her house and how she bought it and her life beforehand.
Yeah, I mean it was a really an amazing story of people who were really tied to their property and it was for different reasons. You know, up the street from Suzette Kelo was the Derry family. They had lived in New London in Fort Trumbull since 1905.
Wow.
Wilhelmina Derry lived in one of the homes. She was born in that home in 1918. Had never lived anywhere else and she was in her 80s when the case started. She wanted to die in the home that she had lived in. She got married in the 1940s. Her husband moved in there with her. Her son and his family lived right next door. They owned two smaller homes on this nice little smaller parcel of land that other family members lived in and sometimes they would rent them out. So their ties to the community were very deep and their ties to this property were extremely deep and that meant so much to them. Suzette Kelo was in a different boat. She had had actually a pretty rough life growing up. She was very poor. She grew up in Maine. She got pregnant when she was 16 years old. She got married shortly after that. She had and raised five children before she was 40. And she was trapped in a marriage that was problematic. And so about around the age of 40, she decided that I'm going to start out on my own. And she went to school. She became an emergency medical technician, then eventually went to school to become a nurse. And she said, I want to have a place of my own. I've never owned a piece of property in my entire life. And so she found this little place when she was out on an ambulance run in Fort Trumbull that was run down. The house was – it hadn't been lived in for I think over a year. But she looked at it, looked at the view of the Thames River out onto the Long Island Sound and said, this is going to be mine. And that it was just a great demonstration of the importance of property rights to a broad range of people, especially those who have never owned anything really in their entire lives. And a year after she had bought it, fixed it up, painted it her favorite color of pink, or she would call it salmon, and moved in, there was a knock on the door from the real estate agent telling her that they wanted her house, and if she didn't sell, they were going to use eminent domain against him.
And when you started looking into – so the first thing was to, you know, standard file a suit or file a claim and then ask for discovery and start looking into the documents about who was behind this. And there's a little bit of Pfizer involvement and all of these different things. And did it just keep getting deeper and deeper and deeper for you?
Yeah. I mean it was – we did a deep dive into the documents and as we were able to demonstrate in court too that I think as Justice Thomas put it in his dissent in Kelo that the development plan was suspiciously amenable to the Pfizer Corporation and what they wanted in their development plan as well. They told the city we'd like to have a 5-star luxury hotel for our employees and guests. We'd like to have private office space. We'd like to have a health club. We'd like to have condominiums for scientists that might be working in our facility for, you know, 6 months or a year, something like that. And lo and behold, the development plan had a luxury hotel, private office space, condominiums and so forth. So but again, it's hard to separate out what was their true motivation for doing this. And again, it was probably a combination of wanting to of course benefit Pfizer, which was seen as their economic savior, and thinking and maybe even believing or at least certainly justifying to themselves that this was going to be for the good of all the citizens of New London.
You've told a story of a very sympathetic woman who went through hardships and this gross unfairness was done to her by the city. But you're an attorney whose job is to advocate for your client, and so is – we can have – of course you're going to present her sympathetically. But is it possible that instead we could look at it like here's a woman who if she were just willing to move – would create all of this – by doing that, she'd create all this good for the community around her. I mean these hotels and health centers and facilities. This is enormous amounts of jobs. This could like completely turn around a town, you know, give it a bright future. And here she is. She just – she won't. I mean, they're gonna compensate her. Like, why won't she just move?
It's the holdout problem,
right? Yeah. Well, and this is something that you know. Of course, the other side had tried to make that point, but they could not make it with a straight face. And I've never seen a case really in the economic development context where you can make this argument in a serious sort of way. The interesting thing about Suzette Kelo and her other neighbors is that they weren't NIMBY people. You know, they were not really – their goal was not to say we don't want anything new in our neighborhood. We want it to be exactly the same way. They said, listen, we want to be a part of this. You know, is the Fort Trumbull neighborhood – has it had better times? Absolutely. Is the city of New London suffering economically? Sure it is. They knew that. But they wanted to really be a part of this too. You know, they said, listen, you have a lot of other land. I mean this was a 90-acre project and the properties amounted to a little bit more than 1.5 acres of property and they were confined to two separate areas. So you had these vast swaths of property and guess what? They wanted to do a mixed-use development in this neighborhood too. They wanted to have homes there, at least condominiums, residential and offices and that sort of thing. So they were saying, listen, you know, let us keep what we have. It's so important to us and let us be a part of any economic revitalization that occurs. I mean one of the outrageous things about it didn't get too much attention during the case and it wasn't – it was an issue in the lower courts but not at the Supreme Court is that the city and the New London Development Corporation said everybody has to go. The whole neighborhood has to be cleaned out. Well, there happened to be a very popular private men's social club located in the Fort Trumbull neighborhood called the Italian Dramatic Club. And when – and this is a gathering spot for prominent people in New London and political leaders. Every time they came to New London and Connecticut and elsewhere, they would always meet at the Dramatic Club. And when those powers that be found out that the Italian Dramatic Club was going to be torn down, they said, well, this is outrageous. We have to save the Dramatic Club. And lo and behold, the New London Development Corporation found a way to save the Italian Dramatic Club as a part of the overall development plan, even though the plan did not call at all for a social club, certainly not an exclusive private men's only social club as well. It caused Matt Derry, whose family was Italian and lived in the neighborhood for years, to quip that the approach of the city was that the Italian Dramatic Club can stay, just all the Italians have to leave.
Now the Dramatic Club though, I think we maybe missed the key here, because that is the smoke-filled room where they planned it all, I imagine.
No question. I'm convinced that they made the plans to save the club in the smoke-filled Dramatic Club.
So how did the lower courts rule on this?
Well, lower courts, it was very divided. We got about 150-page decision from the trial judge in New London. We had a 7-day trial in New London, and there was a split the baby type of decision. There were two parcels that I had mentioned where the homes were located, and he said the one where four homes were located could be taken because he agreed that economic development was a public use. But where Suzette Kilo's home was and the Derry homes and actually most of the – 11 of the homes were, he said it was unconstitutional to take them because the city had no idea what it was going to do with this parcel. They had no development plans really in place. They said it was going to be – it could be – parking, it could be retail, it could be something known as park support, which nobody really even knew what that really was except for the fact that there was a park located across the street from it. And they said his ruling was you can't take people's homes without at least having some idea as to what is going to happen with it. How can you determine whether the takings are necessary, whether it's for a public use? So that was a split decision that went up to the Connecticut Supreme Court. The Connecticut Supreme Court in a 4-3 decision reversed against the property owners on all counts. And so they said it was a public use and then reversed the ruling of the judge with regards to where Suzette Kilo's home was, saying, well, who cares if they don't have any specific plans for this.
And that was actually part of – you had to file in state court first. This is a little bit of legal mumbo jumbo maybe, but it's an important point, something where we're trying to fight, because you had to deal with the exhaustion of in state court, correct, with the Williamson County precedent.
Exactly. And it was just because they had filed – Connecticut's a little odd because they had filed the eminent domain actions in state court, and then you have to file a lawsuit in Connecticut in state court to raise the constitutional issues and others. And so a vast majority of eminent domain decisions come from the state courts. We did raise federal constitutional arguments in addition to state constitutional arguments, and that's what allowed us then to get up to the Supreme Court then as well. The Connecticut Supreme Court, the dissenters in that case wrote a very prescient dissent where they complained about the lack of detail or plans in the area, even calling their approach a field of dreams approach, where it wasn't if you build something people will come, but if you tear everything down, then you hope that people will come to New London. And that issue wasn't really – the Supreme Court really didn't care about that. But as you might mention, as we can discuss what happened in the wake of the Kilo decision, that dissent really, as I said, was prophetic in what had happened.
It's currently empty. I mean, last I checked, I haven't checked recently.
There is no new development in the Fort Trumbull neighborhood whatsoever. Now, 10 years after the Supreme Court's decision was handed down, 15 years since the development plan was approved, 17 years since the project was first discussed, there is no development in Fort Trumbull. The place is a barren field. It is sometimes used as a dump for storm debris when serious storms move through there. There is a nice colony of feral cats that live in Fort Trumbull.
So they benefit.
Yeah, yes. Exactly. They have new homes for themselves. And all the homes are gone and the city has absolutely nothing to show for this. No new tax revenue has been produced. And Pfizer, who was supposed to be the savior of New London, was the linchpin of this whole project in, I believe it was 2009, announced – and the Pfizer facility was next door to Fort Trumbull. It wasn't actually the takings were not for the Pfizer facility itself. It was next door. In 2009, Pfizer announced that it was closing its New London facility and leaving New London just as its tax abatements were expiring.
Now, if I recall correctly, was it one of the majority in the Connecticut Supreme Court decision who later apologized to Cecchillo in person when he met her?
That's right, and that did occur. And he said that, you know, if I would have known then what I know now, and this was several years after the opinion and the outrage and the backlash and the lack of development projects, then he said he would have ruled in a different way. Too late, unfortunately, for the folks in New London. And in the Fort Trumbull neighborhood. But the great legacy that they've left is that the fact that they waged this battle, that they stood up for their rights and in the process have made a very serious transformation of the law on eminent domain, where you've had very serious changes to the law because of the backlash and outrage that occurred as a result of the Kelo decision and the fight that they waged. So that was a great legacy for the Fort Trumbull property owners to have, even though they themselves lost their homes. Homeowners in many states are much better protected as a result of their fight.
The Supreme Court ultimately ruled against Suzette Kelo, and I'm wondering, in the oral argument, did you know then that it was lost?
Well, actually, first of all, did you go up on appeal? Were you losing when you went up, or did you won?
Yeah, we lost. We lost 4-3 at the Connecticut Supreme Court. But the issue was framed very well. That, you know, the dissent had talked about how the Supreme Court had not really addressed this issue, and, you know, it had really framed a lot of state Supreme Courts had come to differing conclusions on it. So the time was right for it. There was growing public awareness and concern about this. A year ago to the day that the Supreme Court agreed to accept Kelo, there was this big piece on 60 Minutes that Mike Wallace did, which is kind of an expose of eminent domain abuse. And that, I think, really raised for the first time the issue to national level that got so many people's attention. And then we got up to the Supreme Court. And to answer your question, I thought it was going to be 5-4, but I just did not know which way it was going to go, because the questions were kind of all over the map. There were two justices that weren't there. Justice Rehnquist was sick at the time, and so he wasn't there. And Justice Stevens, ironically enough, who wrote the opinion, had missed his flight from Florida, coming back to the Supreme Court after the break right before President's Day, and wasn't able to attend the argument. So I didn't know where he was going to stand on this issue. And there was a lot of justices that seemed like Justice Breyer, for instance, looking for some type of middle ground between saying that there was no economic development could never be a public use, but maybe it could not be a public use in certain instances. So I thought maybe it could be a very fractured decision where it would be hard to even find what the rule of law might be on this, because it would be divided depending on how far the court was willing to go. So I thought it was going to be very close, 5-4. I was, of course, hoping for 5-4 in favor of Suzette and her neighbors, but it went exactly the other way. The one frustrating thing, I think the most frustrating thing for us and certainly for me in arguing the case, is that Justice Kennedy just did not seem very sympathetic to our arguments, and that proved to be true because he ultimately was the fifth vote on the court, And I just didn't understand why that was the case. He had been a pretty strong advocate for property rights. He had written in a case, a forfeiture case actually in the early 1990s, that individual freedom finds tangible expression in property rights. And he just did not seem to be very sympathetic. And that was surprising and of course very concerning to us.
And the day that the decision came out, obviously first a ton of disappointment, but then an immediate new plan to – or it had already been discussed, I'm sure, to – we have new stuff. Our quiver is not empty. We have new things to do.
Absolutely. And you know, that's one of the great things about public interest law is that if you lose, you don't just say, well, we lost. We move on to something else. We were determined to take this loss and turn it into a victory in the other areas in which we both litigate in state courts and also through public awareness and grassroots activism and legislative efforts as well. So you're right. We put together a plan within a week's time. We devoted significant resources both with our people and financially to it, and we were going to take what was a genuine outrage about this decision and turn it into something productive as well. And that was something that, you know, when I read especially Justice O'Connor's dissent and how fiery it was and how passionate it was, it wasn't a, you know, a very measured Justice O'Connor dissent. It was clear that she was upset about this, and she wrote it in a way that was going to get a lot of people's attention. And you know, I would be walking down the street, you know, and I'd hear people talking about it. Jay Leno, you know, the night of the decision, asked Arnold Schwarzenegger about it, and people just thought, how could this possibly take place? You know, how could the Supreme Court just – the polling on it was off the charts. It didn't matter, you know, what political party you were in or where you lived in the country. We thought this was a real opportunity to try to change the law.
Do you see anything going forward of that precedent possibly being shaky? Is IJ pursuing anything making – it might be a little shaky now possibly?
Well, sure. I mean, you know, the backlash was significant. It wasn't you know, there were certain problems with the legislation. You know, now if you count both state Supreme Court decisions and legislative and constitutional changes, 47 states have changed their law in some ways. In about half of those states, they're excellent protections. They basically shut down eminent domain abuse, not just the Kelo-style takings, but a lot of states went even further and changed their blight laws that we were talking about, which is even more than we would have gotten out of a positive decision in Kelo, which was fantastic. The other – about half of them though, they were watered down versions of it. Developers and legislators were able to take out some of the strongest provisions. They're better than what they were before, not in every state but in most instances. Some of them are vague and haven't been interpreted, so you don't know what they really mean. But we are concerned that 10 years out from now, even though we've seen these sweeping changes and we've been very encouraged by that, that you're going to see pressure to change back the law. And we're already starting to see that. We have some cases now that we're involved in that we're looking into because memories fade. And you know, the commercial real estate market started to come back now too. That was another thing that factored into the decline, is that the commercial real estate market had tanked, and so there wasn't much need for these types of takings. As that comes back, you're going to see, I think, efforts to weaken the laws and cities and developers once again talking about the need to do this.
So 10 years after Kelo, IJ is now dealing with another form of the government taking people's property.
Although I think that they've been dealing with it the whole time, but we're going to switch gears a little bit here. You know, this is Aaron's transition question, but it's working. It's okay.
Yeah, that's right.
And it happens to be one that's in the news a lot right now, which is civil asset forfeiture.
Yes, that was something that, you know, we've been involved in certainly for a few years. But our intent really was to take this issue sort of like what we did with eminent domain, what we really do with all of our issues, but especially I think the analogy is very appropriate for the eminent domain context. When we first got involved in this in the mid-1990s, very few people had heard about this. Most people were not aware that the government could take your home and give it to Costco or take a business and give it to a condominium developer, and we started a long-term project to try to change the law, raise awareness about this and get the public up to speed on this and get courts more involved in this. And that's exactly what we wanted to do with civil forfeiture as well, to take an issue that most people, probably even fewer people, had heard about this power than they had heard about eminent domain. Some people have this idea, oh, eminent domain is that when they take your property to build a road. Most people have no idea that under civil forfeiture laws, the government can take your property
– in order to buy a margarita
machine. Right, exactly. Yes. And they can take your property regardless of whether you have been convicted or even charged with a crime. And then law enforcement gets to keep that property to buy better equipment, go to law enforcement conventions, buy football tickets, or even in certain instances to buy margarita machines.
So I'm going to ask you to step back here do a little role playing with me because it's so absurd. It is so absurd, the civil asset forfeiture stuff. But I can imagine a listener being like, it can't be that simple. So now you're a cop or you're an advocate on the other side and you're explaining how important civil asset forfeiture is. So what are these arguments of like why they need to be doing this?
Sure. Well, I mean they're going to say it's used to stop crime. It helps us catch the bad guys, that it's necessary to fight the war on drugs or – you know, fight the war against financial fraud or environmental crimes or any number of things for it.
Is that not true, do you think?
Well, it is of course effective in some ways for law enforcement because it's very easy for them to obtain property. What they leave out of that equation is the fact that in America you cannot have an ends justifies the means approach to law enforcement or really to any type of government activity. I would argue that civil forfeiture in fact is not effective even in stopping those crimes because when you have civil forfeiture laws the way they are now where law enforcement gets to keep all or most of their proceeds, you see very perverse law enforcement decisions. For instance, say if you're a proponent of the drug war and you think the government should be fighting the war on drugs, stopping the dealing of drugs. What you'll find out is under civil forfeiture laws, there are certain highways in the country that are known as drug corridors. And there's a lot of places, especially interstates that are long and crisscross the country. You'll find that law enforcement does stings on these highways. Well, studies have shown that on these highways, there's one side of the highway is called the drug side of the highway. The other is the money side of the highway. So the drugs come in typically on the East Coast. The cars are loaded – or on the West Coast and it's distributed out there. They're loaded up and they're then distributed throughout the country and then when the dealers come back, they are coming back through there and that's the money side of the highway. They have all of their cash. Well, guess what side of the highway the cops overwhelmingly favor when doing sting operations?
Oh, let me think.
Think about that if you want to role play about that. So a lot of the places that looked at this, 90% of them on the money side of the highway. And so even if you're concerned, you think that the government should be fighting the drug war, it shows that what they're really – what these laws are really about is – revenue raising and trying to get money.
So you're coming back in on the money side of the highway. You're driving in your car. You just get pulled over. You don't really know why. Let's just say you have $10,000 in your car because you're going to give your dad and he needs a down payment on a new thing and so you withdrew $10,000 and you get stopped. How can they possibly take this? What is the procedure here?
A typical question that most people encounter now if they are pulled over and especially if you meet a certain profile. You know, it could be a rental car. It could be an out-of-state car. It might be how you were driving or sometimes
possibly
even though
race.
They're not supposed to do it, ethnicity or race. Some of the questions they'll ask you, most people have encountered it. Do you know why I pulled you over? Do you have your driver's license? Do you have insurance? And then a new question that's being asked much more frequently is, are you carrying any large amounts of cash on you today? Now, how is that an appropriate question in America? Who cares whether or not you're carrying a large amount of cash on you? But this has become standard fare for law enforcement to do especially when you're pulled over on an interstate. And the reason for that is because they are looking for cash and under civil forfeiture laws, they can seize the currency regardless of whether they have found any sort of illegal activity in your car. So they could seize your currency even if you have no drugs on you, if you don't have any warrants out for your arrest, if you have no other problems whatsoever, they could say, this is a suspiciously a large amount of cash. We think you might be dealing drugs. We think you might be laundering money. So therefore, we're going to seize it. And under civil forfeiture laws, the burden then switches to you to try to get your property back, and you wage a civil litigation with the government where the name of the case is something like United States of America versus $6,400 in U.S. currency.
So it's quite literally true that the presumption of innocence usually we have in these cases flips away from you, and now you have to prove your innocence as soon as the officer is suspicious.
Absolutely.
That's all it takes.
It's probable cause to seize the currency. And then the government merely has to show by preponderance of the evidence some connection between the property and illegal activity, and then – which is a very light burden to meet. And then the burden switches to the property owner in 44 states and at the federal government under the federal standard. The burden then switches to you to prove your innocence rather than for the government to prove your guilt.
But really, who's driving around with large sums of money in their car unless it's drugs or money laundering? I mean, Trevor mentioned you're going to give your dad a down payment so you withdraw $10,000, but who's going to hand him a bag of cash? If it's legitimate, you'll give him a check or a money order or something
PayPal.
Like that.
Yeah.
But the whole point, I mean, the lots of cash just screams like, I don't want anyone to know about this stuff.
Well, I mean, that's true in some instances, of course. You know, some people that are up to no good deal in cash. But there's a lot of legitimate reasons that people have cash. Some people, that's the way they've always done it. Some people get insurance payments. Some people purchase certain things if you're buying from somebody, you know, online, they don't want to deal with checks. They want cash. That's a way of doing it. It's often a cultural thing too, where certain cultures still love dealing in cash, and it's very common for them to do so. And it's also, again, getting back with what happens with eminent domain, is it something that poorer people do, and people who don't have bank accounts, and people who can't get bank accounts, and they oftentimes will have cash on them too for legitimate reasons. But that, you know, doesn't stop the government and law enforcement from taking it. You know, the thing is, there is an alternative to this, and this is what law enforcement doesn't want to talk about, is that they'll say, well, you know, then we can't take people's property, we'll let people benefit from their illegal activity. But there is something called criminal forfeiture, and criminal forfeiture is tied to someone being convicted of a crime and the government showing that the property was the result of that illegal activity, demonstrating it in court the same way you have to deprive somebody of their liberty. You should have to do that with depriving somebody of their property as well. Now, is that more burdensome for the government? Of course.
That's what freedom means.
That's right. That's why we have a constitution, is the government has to meet certain standards. So in all those instances, there's the prospect of criminal forfeiture that would allow the government still to stop people from laundering money or dealing drugs or some other nefarious purpose, and also like something like financial crimes as well. You know, obviously, you know, if somebody's defrauded investors out of millions of dollars and then bought properties with all of that money, yeah, you don't want the person to, you know, then be able to still keep their property. If you show that this is because they stole money from people,
Bernie
Madoff, you know, somebody in that camp. But that's criminal forfeiture, not civil forfeiture. But civil forfeiture is preferred because there's money available and the burden is so much lighter.
One of the weirder things about the civil asset forfeiture is the fact that the cops get to keep the money, which seems – I mean, it would be one thing if it was – you know, so they seize your drugs, then they have to put those in a locker somewhere, destroy them. They don't turn around and resell them or use them themselves or whatever. And so why – when do they get to spend this money?
Yeah.
Because it's – you know, you could make a case for they take it. They think it's suspicious. They're going to hold on for a while, and then if there isn't a case against you, they give it back. But do they – is there some timeline there? Can they spend it immediately? Do they have to hold it for a certain amount of time?
Yeah, they typically can't spend it immediately. They can use it oftentimes if it's a car or something they can use. They can actually hold on to it and oftentimes use it.
And these would be the cards you see that say like I got – it could be the cards that say I got this from a drug dealer or something.
Right. That's usually after it's been convicted. I mean one of the numerous problems with civil forfeiture is the fact that because it's a civil proceeding, the government can just file a claim against the – give you a notice and then file a forfeiture action not against you but against the property. And if you don't come in and defend yourself in civil litigation with the government, then the government can win by default. So if you miss the deadline or you don't know how to do this or you can't afford a lawyer to fight it or you think this is just too much, I don't want to deal with this, the government can just – get a default judgment against you and then the property automatically becomes theirs and then they can spend it under the broad rubric of law enforcement. So typically they have to wait some period of time before they're able to spend it, but then they can spend it as they see fit. And that was really the fundamental transformation of forfeiture law. And this happened in the mid-1980s at the federal level. A lot of states followed suit with that. Before 1984, and went into effect in 1985. But before 1984, at the federal level, forfeiture revenue went into the Treasury's general fund. That was changed in the mid-1980s to give a financial incentive directly to law enforcement. And they said, we get to keep everything that we seize. And another quiz, Trevor. Guess what happened as soon as that law was changed? Did civil forfeiture revenue go up or did it go down? It not only went up but it skyrocketed in use and it has exponentially increased every year since that occurred, and that's why they're doing this. It's not about fighting crime. It's about raising money.
Well, we've seen some of this. I mean, I can imagine a police officer with this incentive who is an unsavory person, especially if it's like $10,000. $10,000 is about what a lawyer would probably cost you to – I mean it's right on the edge of whether or not it's worth fighting. So they say we're going to take $10,000 and we're going to keep it. There's of course this video that went around of the police officers talking about the musical gear. Did you see this one?
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely.
About who gets the drum because they raided a music studio and they found some marijuana. They said, who gets the drum set? I think Bob's kid wants a new guitar. I mean literally that level of piracy essentially.
Right. And you know, this is our point in this we like to emphasize over and over again is that this is not a case of a couple of rogue cops or prosecutors that are doing this. This is a problem with the system itself. It's about the incentives. You know, every economist will tell you, as I'm sure you've interviewed numerous, that incentives matter, and that's true for no matter who you are. And if you give people the wrong incentives, it's not surprising that you're going to see law enforcement behavior skew in the way that's going to favor what opportunities do we have to make money rather than thinking about how are we going to fairly enforce the law today and let's think about which cases should or crime should be a priority. So that's the inevitable result, the behavior that you were talking about in that video and several others of giving people the exact wrong incentives. And it's just incredible going back and looking when these laws were passed. Everybody thought that this was a great idea. This would be wonderful. You know, we'll let the drug dealers and others will have to pay. You know, they have to
have
pay
to
for their
the
own
cops,
enforcement.
Exactly.
You know, and nobody thought about, or very few people, it seems like, thought about the unintended consequences of doing this. But we've seen it play out now over a 30-year period.
And now you had another case where the incentives were interesting in the last couple of years. That got some news too about a motel.
Yes.
That was interestingly owned free and clear and had a – the case is – this is an idea for our listener what they're called. United States versus 434 Main Street, Tewksbury, Massachusetts. Can you tell us a little bit what that case
sure.
is?
Sure. Well, that was a case that just summarized everything that is wrong with civil forfeiture laws. It was a case filed against the property rather than the property owner, and it was a case that was brought about because a DEA agent – was looking for forfeiture opportunities online, and he saw.
Wait, what, is there a clearinghouse for these? How do you possibly do this?
He was looking online at crime reports and news stories and that sort of thing, and he saw news and read accounts of the Motel Caswell in Tewksbury, Massachusetts, which is a budget motel. It's been in the Caswell family. That's who the owners of the property were, although they were just sort of interveners in the case, Russ Caswell and his family. It had been in the Caswell family since the 1950s. Russ bought it from his father in the early 1980s, and his family has run it. And shockingly enough, at a budget motel, there was occasionally drug activity occurred at the motel, in addition to fights and drunkenness. But of course, that happens at budget places. These very crimes also occur at the Ritz-Carlton, at the Four Seasons, and other types of accommodations as well. But they certainly occur, and probably more frequently, at a budget place like the Motel Caswell. There was no allegation whatsoever that Mr. Caswell or his family was involved in any of these crimes. The record showed that Mr. Caswell did what he could to try to put a stop to it. When the police asked him to cooperate with them, he always did, including the cops saying, hey, we think somebody's dealing drugs out of one of the rooms at the motel. We'd like to do some surveillance. And Russ said, sure, why don't you just take a room for free next door to that room to do so? So this was kind of his level of involvement in this. But under civil forfeiture laws, it did not matter. It was – the property was involved in illegal activity. So the federal government teamed up with the local police department. They filed a forfeiture action. The U.S. Attorney's Office did so in Boston, and Russ stood to lose his entire motel because of the actions of independent third parties, his guests who he had no control over whatsoever. And so then that led to a showdown in federal court in Boston.
Are there limits to – I mean this, so this case you won, but before that, were there limits to like the size of the property? I'm wondering because like this – in this case, you can steal a whole hotel because one room was used for drugs. So if I owned like – thousands of acres of farmland and some guy trekked across it to sell drugs to someone else, could they come along and take all my farm?
Well, like, they could certainly make that argument. And there have been cases – a couple things that has happened, and one of the good things that we were able to establish in the Caswell case is that the law was changed back in 2000 at the federal level to add language that said there had to be a substantial connection between the illegal activity and the property. So sort of this – like you were talking about fortuitous uses of property, that should not be a substantial connection. We were able to get good law established on that in the Caswell cases. Courts have generally been pretty good on that, although some courts have not been so good, and that needs to be reinforced. Also, thankfully, the Supreme Court, but only in a 5-4 decision, has said that the excessive fines clause of the Eighth Amendment applies to civil forfeiture, and it's a multi-factored test that they use to try to determine that. So you're not supposed to have situations where you know you could lose your boat because there was pot residue in your ashtray. But those are hotly contested cases. There's a huge amount of law surrounding what might be considered an excessive amount of forfeiture.
And is the reason they haven't gone – I mean like you could – I'm imagining it would be quite lucrative for a police department if they could somehow seize one of the major Vegas hotels that's worth more than this little motel.
But they have the lawyers though. That's
is that the reason they haven't done it? They don't do it?
Absolutely. I mean that's – they typically favor – I mean a lot of these little forfeitures add up. And you were saying too, like with $10,000, you take $6,000. You're right. A lawyer's not going to crack open a book for under $10,000. And people realize they have to either settle, and a lot of forfeiture cases are in fact settled. And that's what the way most – if you make a fuss and you go to the government and you get a lawyer involved and pay the lawyer to do it, oftentimes the prosecutors will say, all right, you know, let's stop fighting about this. We took $10,000. We'll keep $5,000. We'll give
and
you
then it sounds
$5.
Like a great deal to you.
Great deal. Yeah. I mean you know, it's outrageous. You haven't done anything wrong, but you have to take it because you know you're going to quickly exceed the value of the property. And that's one of the – you know, clearly – every budget motel has these problems. We were able to show in the case that the Motel 6 right up the street from the Motel Caswell in Tewksbury had identical problems, some times even worse problems than the Motel Caswell. The parking lots of big box retail stores also are dens of criminal activity, especially low-level drug dealing. They don't go after Walmart. They don't go after Motel 6. They don't go after the Fairfield Inn. The reason for that is because they have to deal then with the big corporate law firms. Oftentimes commercial properties are heavily mortgaged, so you're going to have all these people in court saying, we didn't do anything wrong. We want a piece of this. You know, if you sell it, we want our cut of it. The Motel Caswell was a family-owned, mortgaged-free business that was about $1.5 million on the open market. It was a big piece of property. It was commercially zoned, so it was worth a lot of money. And that's why the cops and the government wanted it. And unlike even in eminent domain cases where at least the property owners get some compensation, it's rarely just compensation, you get nothing. So if Russ and his family would have lost this case, he would have been left with absolutely nothing except a big legal bill, and that was his retirement. That's how most small businesses are. They retire, they sell the property, and that's their pension.
Well, if part of the reason that the cops don't go after bigger players to seize their property is because they're afraid those people will end up are willing to take it to court and then they would lose, the cops would lose, then what does winning cases like this one accomplish? If you still – because you still are going to – even if the courts say yes, they're not allowed to do this and then they do it, you're still going to have to use the courts to say no, this was actually a violation of what we've said.
Yeah, it gives property owners weapons that they have, you know, and it established precedents. And this is the Caswell case is a great precedent for property owners to use, and they have used it. It's been cited in several other cases, and certainly some property owners can fight. It one change in the law that occurred in 2000 at the federal level is that you can now at least get attorney's fees if you're successful in fighting a forfeiture. So that was a great change in the law that at least incentivizes people to do it. But you're right. You know, even with great precedent, other changes have to be made, and that's why we're working to change the law in a much more comprehensive way, not just through litigation, which is essential, but also through public awareness and activism, and then ultimately legislative change then as well. And that's what we're doing in civil forfeiture right now. We started an initiative in 2010 to fight these laws, to raise public awareness of this, to do, of course, the cutting edge litigation. We've issued several studies that document the problems with civil forfeiture. Cato's also done great work in showing the very real issues with civil forfeiture, and they've been doing that for a number of years. And even in the last 6 to 7 months, we've seen this great wave of awareness and outrage building about civil forfeiture, which is leading hopefully to changes both in the behavior of law enforcement, which we've seen even in our cases with where they've been backing down and returning property that they've unjustly taken. And hopefully that will lead once again to really fundamental changes in the law.
And just very recently, we saw Attorney General Holder make some announcements about reforming this. What is he changing?
Right. Well, that was something that was a result, I think, of all of the public pressure that's been building about this.
As and
I
said, no small part by Institute for Justice, because your Philadelphia case, for example, there's been a lot of pressure.
There's been a lot of pressure. We've been doing – we have a class action in Philadelphia. We've been doing several cases against the federal government. We've been working closely with reporters that have done great work. There was a whole series in the Washington Post documented especially highway seizures of currency and other sorts of property that led to serious concern and pushback from also legislators and the like. There was also – it's gotten into popular culture and there was a great piece that probably you guys saw
with John Oliver,
which it did basically a 15-20 minute rant against civil forfeiture that's now gotten, I think the last time I checked, close to 4 million views on YouTube. Again, raising awareness of this. It's one of these things where people hear about it and they say, how could this possibly exist? How could they do this? And so that's been fantastic.
So did Holder fix it?
No, yeah. He did not fix it. And there was unfortunately some news reports that have said, civil forfeiture is basically ended, or at least a certain type of civil forfeiture that's been ended. Now he did take, and we have to give him some credit for curtailing for the first time on his own. You know, for a law enforcement agency to curtail its own powers, it's pretty unusual. And so what he did was that he addressed a certain problem in the law called adoption. And that is when basically a local police department might pull somebody over, seize a certain amount of currency, and then because they'd rather have the feds do it because it's easier for them, or they want to bypass potentially state laws that might give greater protections for property owners or might not allow the money to go back to the court, the cops, they will give it to the federal government will adopt – doesn't that sound great? You know, sounds very, very pleasant. Adopt a forfeiture and continue on and the federal government keeps 20%, 80% goes back to state and local officials. So that was a good change, but unfortunately that only addresses a certain problem and we don't quite know the figures yet, but exact figures with it. But there was an exception in the law, in the Holder policy that allowed for the creation and the ability to still do these types of seizures under joint state and local task forces. So as long as the feds and the states were working together, then they could still continue to engage in these types of seizures. And that is a big loophole and one that has to be closed. Now, the Justice Department has said this is not the first and this is not the last thing that they're going to be doing. This is just the first thing they're going to be doing. So hopefully there will be further steps for it. But it also – and what our concern is that it not be used as an excuse for Congress and other legislative officials to say, oh, problem solved. We don't have to do anything about this. They desperately have to do something about that and hopefully that will continue and we'll see more fundamental changes to the law.
So this has been a interesting sort of tour between two parts of dangers to property rights.
Including my elegant transition between
including – yes, including that elegant transition. Are you optimistic going forward?
You know, I am given what we're seeing even in as little as the last 6 months. You know, we've seen great changes in the law in eminent domain and that's been wonderful to see. But as Jefferson once said and as I'm sure just about all of your listeners are aware of, eternal vigilance is the price and that you cannot – just say, well, it looks like this problem's solved. We can move on and you know stop watching this. You have to stay on this because these can be very fragile gains if you're not out there always making sure that constitutional rights are protected. With what's happening in civil forfeiture, it's been very encouraging to see the movement on it, the momentum building. Now it's a question of what's going to change. I think you're seeing courts more willing to look at these seizures in the same way that courts after years of neglect started looking more carefully at eminent domain takings and you're seeing the public being concerned about this. Legislators now seeing that public pressure have said we've got to start taking a look at this. One encouraging thing too about this is that it seems to unite people across ideological divisions and you're seeing Republicans, Democrats, certainly libertarians that are on board with doing this. It might be an opportunity to put together a true bipartisan effort that would actually be used to curtail government rather than to curtail liberty. So that's been very encouraging too. The challenge of course is what we also faced on eminent domain, we face here, which is a very powerful and very organized opposition to this as well. Law enforcement knows legislators very well. Legislators are very afraid to be on the wrong side of law enforcement in political debates. And once you especially start talking about taking away funds, you're going to get a lot of pushback on this too. So that's something that I don't think the battle has not been fully engaged yet on that. But the progress has been encouraging and we've just got to keep the momentum going on this.
Thanks for listening. If you have any questions or comments about today's episode, you can find us on Twitter at FreeThoughtsPod. That's FreeThoughtsPod. Free Thoughts is a project of Libertarianism.org and the Cato Institute and is produced by Evan Banks. To learn more, you can find us on the web at www.libertarianism.org.